A presentation from Siegel on methodologies used for interest crediting in our reserves.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the board. I'm Paul Angel with the Siegel Company, joined by my colleague John Monroe, and we actually have a potpourri of small actuarial items to go through today. These are, it's sort of once you start looking at one, you start to see others that are closely connected, so they sort of come in sets and in packages. And the first two, of which the only one is our currently topic up for discussion, involves how you credit interest on reserves. And then we'll get in the next item, the related question of what rate of interest you use to credit on the member reserves. That's, in a way, the more interesting item. It actually will affect, to a small degree, benefits, in and out of a member's pocket. Whereas what we're talking about here is really much more sort of an in-the-weeds topic about the details of how interest crediting is done and when changes in interest crediting take place. So we're referring to the letter that you have. It says Agenda Item 5. It's a letter dated August 6th, short letter addressed to Mr. Snyder, signed by John and myself. And the first thing is that, because it says to in the statute, you're maintaining these reserves and you credit them interest, and you do that on a semi-annual basis. Now, the law could have said to do it monthly, which would be a lot of work. The law said it could have said to do it once a year, in which case we would not be discussing this topic. But as it happens, partly because of insurance practice at the time, the reserves are updated twice a year. So this is where we get to talk about compound interest, and there's a nice example of it on the first page of our letter, where if we take the current assumed rate of 7.25, okay, if you take 7.25 divided by 2, this is where I wish it was at 7, not because I want to increase the cost, because it's so much easier to divide 7 by 2, but we have to deal with the fractions. So 7.25 divided by 2 is 3.625. If you think of a 7.25, then it's 3 5/8, if you're thinking of, wrench sizes. So what we're doing currently is we're basically not crediting at 7.25% per year. We're crediting at 7.25% per year compounded semi-annually. And as you may remember from the ads you get from savings loans, compounding more than once a year actually gets you more money at the end of the year, because the interest you earn in the first 6 months of the year then earns interest in the second 6 months. So if you take a dollar and grow it at 3.625% and then grow it at 3.625% again, what you end up with is not $7.25, but $7.38, 7.38, which means that in effect, you're actually adding to all the reserves an amount of interest that's larger than your current assumed rate, because your current assumed rate of 7.25 is always described as an annual effective rate. So the suggestion that's being made here is that we would continue to credit semi-annually, but we would basically back off of that six-month rate to an amount so that when you compound it, boom, it gets right back to 7.25 on the year. And so what this actually shows is that if you're going to compound it semi-annually and you want to end up with 7.25, then instead of compounding at 3.625 every 6 months, you would compound at 3.5616. And in the actuarial exam, there used to be exam number 3 on compound interest, there's even a term for this. They call it I upper 2. It's the number which, when compounded, gets you to an annual effective rate of 7.25. So that's the one proposal that is the change that is being proposed to you for consideration and action. We can pause. You sort of get the sense there. Now, in terms of what effect it has, John, you want to comment on sort of what difference this makes? I will assure you it's a relatively small effect, and because it mainly affects the reserves, it doesn't have a major impact on costs or on benefits, but it does have some small effects. John, why don't you comment on those?
So one thing it'll affect is instead of crediting 7.38 for a year, we'll be crediting 7.25. So member contribution accounts will grow slightly smaller. So any member that gets a refund, they would get a slightly smaller refund. Any member, so any benefit that involves account balance, like option one, that involves the account balance. A few pre- and post-retirement death benefits involve the account balance. Those would be affected, but these are all generally pretty small effects. Contribution rates, again, would not really be affected because Your guys process, because you guys have a contra tracking account, which I think you got a training session on that before. I mean, ultimately, you know, whether you credit 7.38 or 7.25 to all the reserves, we ultimately go back to how much money you actually earned, and any difference will go into the contra account. And we use the reserves net of the contra account. So that value we anticipate would be pretty much unaffected.
Right.
I'm a little confused. How would it not affect it, though? It's a change.
It affects it, but it affects it slightly.
Make the change, even though it's slight, right?
I think so. Now, let me take a suppose it's many years in the future and the contra account is gone. Just for full disclosure of mechanics, okay? You know, right now, in effect, the reserves are demanding 7.38 before earnings would be considered excess earnings. And you always see air quotes when we say excess earnings, right? And whereas you might have thought that any earnings above 7.25 would be excess earnings. If you make this change, because now your interest crediting will be consistent with the 7.25, in that way in the future year when there's no contra account and you earn more than your assumed rate, let's say you earn 10, I mean some big number, under current practice, only the difference between 7.38 and 10 would be considered excess. And now, the difference between 7.25 and 10 will be considered excess. So you could say, oh, you're creating more excess earnings. Well, we're simply measuring excess earnings on a basis that's truly consistent with what you think your rate is, and that's 7.25.
Yeah, the rates are so important to the members, especially when we went from 7.75 down to 7.25. So is that going to be a positive impact where we positive toward the member and the sponsor would both be paying less?
Well, interestingly enough, you know, now check me on this, John, for the member rates. You see, the member rate calculation is done according to something that's in the statute, or it comes out of the actuarial report. All of those, there's no semiannual compounding in that. So this does not change the member rate. If it had, we would have, it's not like you're changing the member rate from 7.38 to 7, sorry, it's not like you're changing the earnings assumption on which the member rate is based, right? You're not changing that from 7.38 to 7.25. That's always been 7.25. This is only in the reserve crediting. And that's why we're able to say it's de minimis, because it's things like refunds of contributions and sort of the ongoing balance between what is excess earnings and what is not excess earnings. It moves that line a little bit. And that's why it will have some effect in terms of what goes into the contra account. And when there's no contra, way in the future, it'll have some effect on what's considered excess earnings. But we're not changing the rate that's used for that.
You've done a wonderful job explaining, so I'm going to go ahead and make the motion to change the methodology for the rate of interest that is credited to reserves to be the semiannual compounded rate that would result in an annual rate that equals the investment return assumptions based on the 7.25%. Investment return assumption, the semiannual crediting rate would be the 3.5616%.
Could you repeat that?
Want me to repeat it?
Is there a second? There is a second.
Second.
Is there a second? Is there further discussion?
Rusty?
Well, are we making this effective fiscal year 14-15? When is this going to go?
It looks like there are two motions, is how I read the write up on it. So the effective date would.
So this is the first motion.
This is the first motion.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
So I just want to be clear, this does affect member, not contribution rates, but it does affect member accounts. Like John was saying, if somebody cashes out at the end, they're going to actually be credited less interest per year. Question is, based off the effective rate, if somebody's been in the system for 20 years as of today and we make it effective tomorrow, do they receive the 7.5 for a majority of that time and now the 7.25? With the previous, essentially the 7.38 effective. Right. Do they receive that, or is it
retroactive.
Calculated it is when they terminate?
It is not retroactive. We would not go back, just like when you change the assumed rate. You don't go back and change earlier assumed rates. You could think of this as it's as though you're changing the assumed rate on which interest is credited. It is prospective only.
Okay, so I guess so. We have a methodology in place internally for accounting or for the actuary that is calculating. It's not when the employee cashes out that they're calculated at that rate, right? Is that correct?
It's already been credited. Up to this date, it's already been credited to member accounts.
starting balance would not change.
Each member can ask on any given day how much is their account balance with interest. That number is standing ready to go. Mm-hmm. We're not undoing that. And I understand your question. It's not that, oh, well, now that you've asked, we'll go back and calculate that. No, that would be really hard to do, for one thing. So this is maintained on a current basis.
Sports tried difficult things in the past, so I wouldn't be surprised. Okay, that clears it up for me. Thank you.
Like your bank account.
Right. It is. Oh, by the way, that will come up in a later topic. How much do you earn on your bank account? I guess, it's not 7.25. That's a later topic. It's later on.
We're still on item 5.
We have a break in the action.
John's getting ready to call both.
Right. Correct. Both of these motions should be made at 6.
Okay.
Strictly speaking,
5 is now completed. We're on 6. Nope. We're in motion 1.
We haven't voted.
6.
No.
I haven't voted yet. I know we haven't voted yet. I'm just clarifying our numbering in our agenda with our vote. Okay. Presentation on 5, votes on 6.
But there's still another part of
it. We need to make that a future presentation and consider possible action so that it's one thing, because that does get a little confusing.
Yeah. Second part of 5?
The second part of 5 is talking about the implementation.
Right.
Right.
I mean, if you want to give this, I suppose you could say there's a 5A and a 5B and a 6A and a 6B.
Let's do it that way.
The way the agenda is.
Yeah. Well, you could move on to the next item. You could table the rest of item 5, and whatever you want to do.
Okay. We can table the rest of item 5 for the vote, untable it for the discussion leading into the second motion, second vote.
Well, okay. I got a procedural. No, I think we need them.
5 and 6 can be.
I think we need to take them because I'm concerned that the motion that's made now, if further discussion changes this current motion, that isn't how we should do it. Let's take a vote on what we just discussed and move on mm-hmm. to the next item. That's my, I think that makes it easier for everybody to know where we're all at. Because I don't want to, if what you're suggesting, John, is we've got through 11 here.
No, we're on 5 and 6.
We're on 5 and 6. I thought I heard you say you wanted to delay the vote on the motion.
No.
Well, I was envisioning two motions, and we've had one of them that's been moved and seconded. Okay, the second motion is the effective date of applying this. I suppose we could add it to the first motion.
Yeah, let's make it all.
Well, Mr. Chair, the effective date question is more than simply the effective date of the motion that has already been made. It says effective date. This has to do with the effective date going forward of whenever any change is made in the interest crediting rate. It's a broader topic, and it is its own standalone topic. It's not just the effective date of the motion and second that's just been made. It's bigger than that. So you actually have under item 5 a discussion of two things. Under item 6, you have vote on two things. We have now discussed one of the two things. We have a motion and second on one of the two things. But I think in order to vote on it, you're going to have to close 5, go to 6 where the vote is. But I'll defer to Harvey and to general counsel on the process.
Mr. Chairman. I think that's what John is suggesting to do. So the vote can take place under item 6 on the motion that was made. And then you can proceed back to item 5 for the continued presentation.
That's all.
And the vote on the effective date.
Thank you.
Yes.
That seems like the straightforward way to do it. All right. So let's go ahead with the vote. Any further discussion on the vote? Motion on the floor. If not, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstain? Okay. Let's go back to 5.
5 for the continued discussion. And for this, we move to our, it's the same letter. Okay, it's still the August 6th letter, but now we're on page 2 where it says effective date of new interest rate. As I mentioned, this is not just the thing you just voted on. This is any time you change your expected rate of return. When does that go into effect? Well, changing the effective rate of return does a couple things. It changes the contribution rates, right? It changes the current member contribution rates. It changes the current employer contribution rates. And for that, there is an 18-month delay between the date that's on the valuation. So I have here the December 31, 2012 valuation. If that had new assumptions in it, a new earnings assumption, when you adopt the valuation, you would adopt those rates, The new rates, member and employer, go into effect 18 months later, which would be July 1, 2014. Right? So we're not recommending a change in that part. And that's done largely because of timing issues, and you have an item later on your agenda, by the way, which will go into that whole question about the 18-month delay on implementing the contribution rates. But now, let's talk about, suppose you lowered the earnings assumption from 7.25 to 7, just as an example. The contribution rate impact would show up 18 months after the valuation in which those were first reflected. But what about the interest crediting? I mean, you're already the members' counts are accruing. The valuation, you know, thinks that now going forward, money is only going to earn 7% instead of 7.25 under that, if you adopt that new assumption. And so your current practice, though, is during that 18-month delay where you're waiting to implement the contribution rates, you're also continuing to credit interest on the members' accounts and on all of your reserves at the old rate, in our example, 7.25. So the proposal here is, if you're going to drop the expected rate of return on, for example, December 31, 2014, it's not up for action, but you know, if that happened, instead of waiting until July 1, 2016 to start crediting interest at that new rate, you would actually start crediting interest at the new rate right away as of December 31, 2014. And the reason you can do that is you don't actually credit the interest until the end of the six-month period. And by that time, generally, you will have adopted the new valuation. Everything will be in place. So you already know that that's going on. Actually, it's even better than that. If we ran the valuation at the new rate of 7%, you already know that you had an earlier discussion to adopt that new assumption. So by the time you get to December 31, 2014, even though we've just run the valuation, everybody knows what the new interest rate is, in my example, 7%. And so it would be there's no administrative delay required to start using that new interest rate when you credit the interest on the reserves going forward. I said that because, you know, sometimes we have a delay in getting the valuation done. You could have said, well, what happens if at the end of that six-month period the valuation isn't done yet? Actually, it doesn't matter because crediting interest at the new rate doesn't require any results from the valuation. All it requires is that you've adopted the new rate, and you would already have done that because we had that in place when we did the valuation. All right, I didn't say that last part as clearly as I'd hoped to, but the idea is that it's much easier to put a new crediting rate into effect than it is to put into effect contribution rates that are based upon the new crediting rate, because the contribution rates require us to finish the valuation, have you adopt them, have them sent to the employer, have the employer adopt them, whereas to simply start crediting interest at the new rate simply requires that you go to your computer programs that do that and cross out. So actually, you cross out the 7.25 and write in 7. Of course, you actually cross out 7.25, you know, to the square root, the whole thing we just did at the earlier action. So the idea is, instead of continuing to credit members at the old rate and all your reserves, not just the member accounts, that you would start crediting them at the new rate, basically on the same date that that rate is adopted for the valuation. I think, John, is there anything else crucial on this topic? Well, yeah, then there's the one that really surprised me. All right, so let's use that same example. Suppose you lower your expected return on assets from 7.25 to 7 as of the December 31, 2014 valuation, I suppose. Now, you know, your asset smoothing method, the key feature of that is you smooth against the expected return. So in our example, during 2014, that's the year before the valuation, when your assumed rate was still 7.25, whatever you actually earn, you would compare it to 7.25, and any difference is spread over 5 years, one-fifth recognized now, one-fifth recognized going forward. But the thing that you're smoothing against is that 7.25. I will tell you, before we did this project, in the example I'm using, if you lowered the rate to 7% as of December 31, 2014, I would have thought, well, then when we're doing asset smoothing for the year 2015, well, we're already in 7% territory. So we would take the actual earnings during 2015, and instead of smoothing it against 7.25, we'd smooth it against 7, because that's what we think the market is expected to earn during 2015. Turns out no, because there's a link between the way the reserves are credited and asset smoothing. It's because you need to do the asset smoothing in order to do the reserve calculation. That same 18-month delay that applied to interest crediting also applied to asset smoothing, which means that you actually did not start smoothing against the new rate of return until, in our example, 2016.
So is all this like new stuff, or is it ongoing, or is it just a light bulb went off?
This is a light bulb went off. I mean, I think it started with in discussions between your staff and ours. The idea that we're crediting interest at a rate other than what we're actually assuming in the valuation. Okay, that was the item you just took. Okay. And then, again, it was a light bulb for me, and John keeps secrets from me on these things, I guess, but it was a light bulb for me that we actually were not doing the asset smoothing until a year later than I thought we were. So that's bad on me for not knowing. But again, it's what happens when you got the asset smoothing, which really isn't necessarily connected to this all reserving stuff. When you got that sort of entangled administratively with this every 6 months interest crediting process. So yeah, it's a bit of a light bulb. Yeah, so I think these are sort of cleanup items. I do think that when you go to, if you think that the assets in 2015 are going to earn 7, then you should be smoothing against 7. And that shouldn't be affected. You shouldn't not do that just because, well, we're doing this reserving thing differently. So that's why this is kind of a package. We think this is a good result in both areas. You get more up-to-date interest crediting. You get more up-to-date asset smoothing.
Scott?
I'm prepared to make a motion, but I wanted to ask our outside counsel and general counsel, if they have comments or observations on this item.
Mr. Chairman, just one question. Paul, is there a reason to set this in policy now for all prospective future years, or would it be just as well for the board to consider it on an annual basis when it's setting these rates?
No, this would definitely be an ongoing policy. Yeah, because number one, we really think this is an improvement in policy, and so it's something that it's almost like asset smoothing. Once you pick 5 years, it's 5 years until you change your mind. Now the difference there is you might actually change your mind on asset smoothing. I don't think this is going to go back. So I would call this an improvement in policy. It's a one-time deal.
Done. Oh, Will?
Yeah. Paul, so in terms of your experience with other agencies, 1937 Act, either a sample or a population of what are they doing also?
I think that most of them are doing it the way we're proposing, and I'll tell you what, the ones that aren't, we're going to go have the same conversation with them. Now, John, tell me if I got that right or wrong.
Well, I'd say most of them are doing what you're currently doing
now. We have work to do. So.
Yeah. And you kept mentioning 7% and 7.25%. That was just an example.
Oh, yeah, just for round numbers.
I just wanted
numbers.
To be clear.
We're very clear on that. Yeah,
that
yeah,
no, that's just me too.
I could have used 11 and 11 and a half. would that be better? We do that. Yeah, okay.
Get in the newspaper.
Yeah. I know. Oh, yes, we should make sure everyone knows.
Karen, did you have any
comments? It was just an example. Okay.
Yeah. I'm going to move the recommendation from Siegel & Company, second item of the conclusion. With the new interest rate effective when the interest crediting period that follows the valuation date for which the new investment return assumption is effective.
Second. Okay. Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Abstained?
On a roll.
How about that, Paul? Was that easier for you than you
thought? I know. Yeah, we're going to talk about our new contract. Such an agreeable mood here.
A reduction of 30%.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, let's see if we can get something going here then.
We are to 7.